Good morning, and I apologize that we're a bit late. It's totally my fault. I take full responsibility for everything else that goes wrong. It's the rest of them. The first item on our agenda today is the misdemeanor bond schedule, and under the statutes and rules, this court has to approve the misdemeanor bond schedule. We have gotten that from Nancy Rotier. Nancy, if you'd approach the bench. And I'm going to ask the court if anyone has any questions about the bond schedule. We approve this every year. That is a new bond schedule every year.
Great.
Are there any questions of Ms. Rotier? Ms. Rotier, hearing no questions, is there anything that the court wants to say about this? If not,
good work.
The order prepared by
the court has approved the bond schedule.
Right.
Thank
now
you,
I'll prepare the order and have it at your office.
Pardon me?
I'll have the order prepared and
then
back to your office. Thank you.
We will next take up the rules petition 04-04, amendment of Supreme Court Rule 70.14(1) to include two court commissioners on Planning and Policy Advisory Committee, filed by the Wisconsin Association of Judicial Commissioners and the Wisconsin Family Court Commissioners Association. Who is appearing on behalf of this? This is Stephen D. Meyer, President, Wisconsin Association of Judicial Court Commissioners, and the other appearance is Darcy E. McManus, President, Wisconsin Family Court Commissioner Association. If anyone else wishes to appear on this matter, please advise Cornelia Clark, our Clerk of Supreme Court. Mr. Meyer.
Chief Justice Abraham, Justices, good morning. Thank you very much for having this here. Just before the hearing, I saw the memo from Judge McGonigal from the Planning and Policy Advisory Committee agreeing that they would be happy to accept one court commissioner, but given the size of the committee, they would prefer not to have two court commissioners. I would assume that your question would be why we would want to have two court commissioners, why there would be a need for that. As this court recognized in creating the committee and having 13 circuit court judges, there are diverse circumstances that the circuit judges face in all the kinds of different situations, whether it's urban or rural, whether it's a multi-judge county, those sorts of things. You recently asked us all to complete a time study survey so that you could get a better handle on what it is that all of us do. Our anachronistic name, Wisconsin Association of Judicial Court Commissioners, came because we actually came into being as a result of the proposed rules that affected all of us as circuit court commissioners, and for that matter, non-circuit court commissioners, all practicing as court commissioners at all. The Family Court Commissioners Association and we have no problems with each other whatsoever. We formed the separate group because there is a definite difference. A lot of the Family Court Commissioners are part-time independent contractors for the counties. They are obviously specialists, experts in their field, and we are generally generalists. And since we've been largely responsible for our own judicial education under the rules, it was really necessary to have the different groupings in part because of the education that we had to supply. We do meet once a year at the same time so that we can talk to each other. But I think that the Supreme Court in Rule 7015, the very next rule about the judicial conference, recognize the importance of both by having a designee from each organization. One last thing in that respect is that most of the appointments, not all of them, are determined, are picked by the association. And I think that's an important thing. It makes sense. And in our particular circumstances, we have those two organizations already in effect and have for quite some time and for the reasons that I've stated.
Can a family court commissioner do the work of the a court commissioner?
Yes, absolutely.
And can a court commissioner do the work of the family court commissioner?
Yes. And at least in our county and probably in most, all of the circuit court commissioners are appointed for all purposes. We have some, obviously, they're probate court commissioners, some of whom are registered in probate, some of whom are not. But the powers generally are given to all.
I have a question. How many members, or perhaps you could just give an estimate of each group, family court commissioners? I used to be a family court commissioner, so I... And the court commissioners, how many are in those groups?
An excellent question. There are approximately 40 in terms of the judicial court commissioners. And I'd have Darcy answer in terms of...
Slightly over 100.
They're obviously the larger and older organization.
Commissioner Meyer, is there any reason why you couldn't rotate a representative on PPAC? In other words... one term would be someone from your group, and the next term would be someone from the Family Court Commissioners group?
As soon as I saw the memo, I thought that would probably be the first question, and that certainly seems like a reasonable alternative. Obviously, we would be happy to have a court commissioner on there, and I think that is a reasonable compromise.
I just want to say that... the court has, in appointing various committees and commissions, and has appointed family court commissioners and judicial court commissioners to committees and commissioner commissions, and has found that their perspective is very useful. And I want to thank both organizations and members thereof for their participation and their hard work.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief Justice.
And one example is on the Administrative Oversight Board for OLR, as you know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask?
I'm sorry. Justice Prosser has a question.
Prosser.
Appointment to PPAC would certainly enhance the recognition of court commissioners, and I think that's very important. But could you identify one perspective or one viewpoint or one problem that is not being adequately addressed because of the absence of court commissioners?
A very good question. I think the biggest thing right now is, and we understand the financial circumstances, is that we're required to have the judicial education, and that is not being supplied. I think both organizations have done a good job in doing that. Obviously, we can get CLE and other credits, and often the Judicial Education Office has been very fine in terms of our being able to get credit for the various things. But that is a huge consideration, I think.
It's not one that PPAC has worked on, though.
True.
It is one that the Judicial Education Committee has worked on and has considered and had input from the court commissioners on education. And our problem is funding, as you know.
Exactly.
That's been the difficulty in that area, and both your organizations have done a wonderful job in helping to fill that void. So that's good. But there may be other things like court reporters that you're interested in that is a major issue in PPAC.
Certainly. And with all due respect, Chief Abramson, Chief Judge Justice Abramson, we have, it was PPAC that brought in the requirement for the education. The court has certainly been concerned about pro se representation, and obviously we meet the majority of people coming through the system, and in all of those different aspects, family court and everything else, that has a big impact on what we do, and we're the face of the court system to a large extent.
Is there some area of concentrated study and review that PPAC is not doing that you would be pushing, your organizations would be pushing one or the other?
Not that I'm aware of, Justice Prosser. I think it's just the idea of being able to have some input on what they are doing.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ms. McManus.
As you know, I am Darcy McManus. I'm president of the Wisconsin Family Court Commissioners Association. Just a bit of background. Every single county in the state has a circuit court commissioner who is specifically assigned to address family matters.
That's by statute.
That's by statute. Now, the larger counties have circuit court commissioners who do other matters, the probate, small claims, a variety of other of traffic matters, some bail hearings, and so forth. That's not consistent throughout the counties. You'll find, I think, in the largest counties, they are each person in the circuit court commissioner is focused on one area. In the smaller counties, many of us do many of those, have many of those responsibilities. In the very smallest counties, you may have only a circuit court commissioner who does very part-time family work. And it really depends on the requirements of each individual county of how much assistance that particular judge needs. In that respect, I think it would be difficult for someone from the Judicial Court Commissioners Association. I know those are not statutory terms, but we do need to identify ourselves by our responsibility. Someone from the Judicial Court Commissioners to really understand the requirements of the Family Court Commissioners. In other words, we handle a lot of things that the judges never see. For example, temporary hearings are almost never handled by a judge. Those are strictly court commissioner functions. We see a lot of, as Steve indicated, a lot of pro se litigants. I would say in family law cases, statewide, probably more than half of the cases have at least one pro se litigant. In Milwaukee County, that's even higher. So that is a very much of a concern for us, and we see a lot of that. In the family law cases, very, very few of the cases actually go to trial. I don't have exact statistics. I know it's less than 5%, probably much less than 5%. Many of the family litigants never see a judge. Some of the counties have, the judges have pretrials, but that would be the extent, and sometimes that's not even with the parties. So we are, as Steve indicated, the
face of the court system. What do the judges do, sign the orders?
Often not even that. The court commissioner can hold the temporary hearing, can manage all of the matters that are preliminary to the final hearing. A stipulated agreement can be heard by a court commissioner who would actually sign the judgment and all the attendant papers. So the judge may not ever see a family law case. And conversely, the family law litigant may never see a judge. They often call us judge. They don't know who we are. They know that we're just the person sitting up hearing their case. So I think that's the... Yes.
Curiosity. Are the stipulated cases that you enter judgment on, are those cases that are stipulated from the get-go? You know that when they come to a temporary hearing? Or are they cases that you have a temporary hearing, it is scheduled on the judge's calendar for a contested hearing, perhaps, you know, maybe it's a small matter, an hour contested hearing, and close to the trial date, it settles?
Yes, to both.
Who hears the final hearing?
Many of the cases are scheduled in front of the judge for a final hearing, and they may settle before that date. Many of the cases are settled from the outset. People know what they want when they go in. Other cases settle as the case moves through the system, some sooner and some later in the process. And that will vary from county to county. In some cases, the judges say, if you settle, you go to the family court commissioner and you have your final hearing, even if it's scheduled on the judge's calendar. Other judges will say, you know, if it's right up to the day and they settle on the day, the judge will hear the final hearing. But a great percentage of the final stipulated divorces, regardless of when they stipulate, will be heard by the family court commissioner.
Could you help me? What is a temporary hearing? Does that involve just with divorces or what?
Just divorces. It's unique to divorce hearings, and they are provided for in the statutes that any divorce litigant who wants to have certain things set up as a temporary order, just to manage how the case is going to go, where the children are going to be is a big issue often, who's going to be living in the former marital residence, who's going to be paying the debts. Pardon me?
Maintenance.
Support.
Child support.
Or child support. All of those issues can be addressed at temporary order hearings. Now, we all, and it's sometimes a problem because a lot of times people come in and they want the whole thing settled at this first hearing date, which might be 2 weeks after the case has been filed. So there's not nearly enough information, number one. And number two, we really can't make final orders at that stage. It's not right. The people are still moving through this, what we call the emotional process of divorce. Some of them know that this has been happening. Others have been surprised by it, and they haven't really figured out what they want to do. They haven't figured out where the children are going to be or who's going to take the house. And these are big issues to these people. So we set up temporary orders, and they are in, at least I think from most of our perspective, they're not prejudicial in any way. In other words, if we set up an order and somebody says it's not working, they can come back in. They don't have to show change of circumstances. This is a transitional time for these families. They don't know what's going to work yet. And we like to encourage them to settle things, to try things out. So we say, if you try something that doesn't work, you come back and we'll take care of it. Some cases we see 5, 6, 7 temporary hearings before they get settled. That's usually where there are child custody and placement issues. Others, we don't have any. The norm is probably to have one.
How much interaction is between the two organizations?
As Steve said, we do meet jointly once a year. The family court commissioners meet twice a year. I don't know how often
we do as well.
You meet twice a year also. So in a county where there are commissioners in both areas, where there are multiple commissioners, they have, of course, independent interaction. But for me, I have fairly limited interaction with someone who's designated as doing more judicial work. Even though I do some of that work myself, my primary focus is on family.
Commissioner McManus, do you now have representation at the judicial conference?
Yes.
And the other organization, the Judicial Commissioners, does as well?
Yes. In fact, I attended it last year myself.
And as far as the education requirement, even though you're struggling with that, there aren't funds available. Is it working out? Are you having regular educational sessions?
We think, frankly, it's working pretty well. Our organization does it, and it's all volunteer on our part. But we find that because we are so focused on family law and so intimately involved with it day after day, every day, that we know the issues that we want addressed, and we've been able to find our speakers and do some of it ourselves, in fact. So we, at least from the family court commissioner's standpoint, we've been pretty satisfied that with the way you've allowed us to do it, to provide our own education. They do have to be overseen. David Haas does have to approve all of our programming. I think if you'd ask him, he'd say that he's never had a problem with what we've done.
Judicial education sees the agendas and approves them, and that's been a very important and successful way of educating, especially in the family court, which is a specialty. So that's very good. And judicial education programs are open to court commissioners when there's room
Yes, they need to save our space. And we very much take advantage of that. Many of us go to the family, and particularly the juvenile, those of us who do some juvenile work. We're very grateful to have that opportunity. A lot of us take advantage of it.
And we've just come through, I think, one of the first annual runs to where judicial education has been required, and it appears that that the commissioners are complying, and that's good.
If I may, it seems to me that the issue might boil down to not if there's going to be someone on feedback, but one or two. And looking at 70.14, I note that the municipal judges, and I'm not sure that's comparable, but I throw that out, has one member. The Board of Governors appoints two from the statewide attorneys. And then, of course, other listings in terms of membership. Are you maintaining a position that there should be two rather than one? And if so, what benefit is two over one?
We'd love to have a position. We'd be very grateful to have a position. I think that two would bring two distinct perspectives to PPAC. As I say, the family court is very focused. Family court commissioners are very focused on family law with these types of hearings that nobody else hears, where we see a lot of people. It's a big volume in divorce cases. We see a lot of people come through there. Whereas the judicial court commissioners see traffic, small claims, juvenile, probate. Have I covered it? Mostly. And they bring a different perspective as well. Again, high volume. You're in traffic court, which I also do, by the way. That's a huge volume of taking pleas on speeding tickets. And
you must be exhausted at the end of the
week. It's a long day. But if you have one representative, of course we'd have to choose that representative very carefully. We'd want to have somebody who could represent this wide diversity. The difficulty will be that we don't have the, at least currently, we don't have the constant interaction because we do focus on our two areas that we've identified as being our primary focuses. So we do it, but I am arguing for two. I think it would bring something to PPAC. One, you know, two more bodies would be, I understand they have a large group already.
Right.
And so that's your call, obviously.
Right. Thank you very much, Ms. McManus.
Thank you very much.
And my thanks, as I said, to Mr. Meyer, not only for this petition and your appearances, but the work you've done in education of commissioners and keeping high standards. Thank you both. Does anyone else wish to appear on this matter? As far as I could tell, there was only one letter or other piece in the file, and that was from Judge McMonigo. Okay. That closes the hearing on 04-04, Amendment of Supreme Court Rule 70.14 relating to PPAC. I will now call our hearing on the next matter, which is Rules Petition 0403, Establishment of a System of Licensure for Regulation of Paralegals, filed by the State Bar of Wisconsin. The presenter will be Michelle Benke. And I'm going to list the appearances, and I am going to ask that everybody limit their remarks. If you have filed a written statement, and there have been any number of them, please do not repeat the statement. We've read them. So highlight your comments, because my goal is to complete this within, I'm hoping, an hour, so the court can meet, because the court has a full closed conference for this afternoon. So timing is very important. Now, this is a very important issue, and we will proceed. So I've got Owen Durgan, Richard Opie, Regina Reynolds, James A. Stewart, John Decker, Mary Lynn Donahue, Stephen Levine, John Goody, and James W. Moore. If anyone else wants to appear, please give your name to Cornelia Clark. Ms. Benke. And who's your friend?
Good morning.
Friend.
I am bringing up your friends.
Okay, so it's John Decker and Mary Lynn Donahue. Okay.
Yes. Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. I'm Michelle Benke, and I'm here as President of the State Bar of Wisconsin. As has already been noted, past President John Decker and Attorney Mary Lynn Donahue are also here on behalf of the State Bar. Given the court's admonition, what I'd like to do very briefly is set a little background. Then Attorney Decker will give you the substance of what brings us here on our petition, and Attorney Donahue will discuss the educational requirements. Very briefly, on June 28, 2000, the State Bar Board of Governors passed by more than a 60% majority the petition, or supported the petition, which is before you. That's the requirement in order to be before you on this issue today. By way of background, the Paralegal Task Force was really an outgrowth of the Delivery of Legal Services Commission. When that commission did its work, it issued a number of recommendations, and among those recommendations was a suggestion that we look at the requirements for use of paralegals so that we could expand the range of activities traditionally performed by paralegals, thereby potentially increasing the use of paralegals and the availability and affordability of legal services for the low and moderate income persons in Wisconsin.
How does that work out here?
Pardon me?
As a practical matter, how does that work out here?
As a practical matter, if a lawyer is able to delegate certain tasks to a paralegal at a lower hourly rate, the overall legal services may be more affordable to the public.
To the extent you require licensure and increased education, then the rate for that paralegal will go up.
Perhaps, but the difficulty is that currently there are absolutely no standards with regard to who can call themselves a paralegal, the education or training, and so for instance, a lawyer might hire someone that they believe would be capable of producing that type of work who really is not, and conversely, you have people who are out there that are in fact practicing law who have not had the training of an attorney.
Do you foresee the, let's say there would be one lawyer and 8 or 10 paralegals in a firm? In other words, the idea is that the lawyer would supervise, but I'm just envisioning what this would be, or would one lawyer be supervising 20 paralegals, and you would have a for-profit operation business, but it would be mainly made up of paralegals with one lawyer who would be the supervising lawyer.
The petition does include the requirement that the paralegal's work is supervised by a lawyer, well, and the lawyer would ultimately be responsible. There is nothing in the petition, and we would not presume to dictate to a lawyer how best they could supervise that, and if the lawyer believed that they could supervise 10 paralegals or if they could supervise 2 paralegals, the lawyer would ultimately be responsible for whatever he or she determined was an appropriate number to supervise.
But 7, maybe I should direct this to Mr. Decker. Bowen, I'll state the question and then you can, okay, we'll let Ms. Benke finish. 7.5 deals with firm names and letterheads. And that would indicate, and I think that may be the genesis of Justice Wilcox's question, that you could have a firm name or trade name and a freelance practice of 100 mm-hmm. paralegals.
I was trying to be conservative.
Well, 100 is conservative. With one or two, and you could have 10 supervising attorneys as a freelance paralegal firm. And I just want to know, but we can wait, and we've interrupted you, so give us the background, but I think that's the genesis of the question.
Thank you. As I indicated, the Delivery of Legal Services Commission had this concept of addressing the unmet legal needs of the poor and working poor. Over the course of the next 3 years, the next step is that, in fact, we, the State Bar and others, became aware of the fact that paralegals, both state and national, were concerned about this same issue, that there were no standards for who could call themselves a paralegal, and they did, in fact, have a desire to have an increased professional stature to their work. And, in fact, the Paralegal Association of Wisconsin worked to introduce legislation that would, in fact, ultimately license them, and their regulation would ultimately be handled by the Department of Regulation and Licensing. The State Bar of Wisconsin came together with paralegal groups, and we also included representatives of OLR, at the time it was BAPR, and BBE, to sit down and try to work out these issues and find a logical way to address licensure and to address the possibility of increased services to the poor and working poor. That's where the Paralegal Task Force came in, and Attorney Decker was the vice chair of that committee, and Attorney Mary Lynn Donahue was a member of that committee, so they'll have more to say on how the task force did its work. Over the next 3 years, the Paralegal Task Force did sit down and try to work through these issues, and the petition that is before you is the culmination of their work. The State Bar is here in support of this petition for several reasons, but the two principal ones are that the Supreme Court, by virtue of the Wisconsin Constitution, is really the best body suited to address regulation of the practice of law, and that is what paralegals are participating in. This court said in In Re Integration of the Bar that the primary duty of the courts as a judicial branch of our government is the proper and efficient administration of justice, and the practice of law in its broadest sense, both in and out of courts, is such a necessary part of and is so inextricably connected with the exercise of the judicial power that this court should continue its supervisory obligations with respect to the practice of law. And then second, that the intent of this petition is to establish criteria for the licensure of paralegals so as to encourage their use and to provide for an efficient way to provide legal services to the underrepresented while at the same time protecting the public interest. I'll turn it over to Attorney Decker to discuss the substance of the petition.
I just have one question, and that is, one of the issues is you don't want people who are not licensed to practice law, practicing law, right? That the definition of paralegal is somebody, and I'll paraphrase it and it'll be too loose, who's doing something that a lawyer would ordinarily do, right?
It is.
So doesn't this whole petition depend on another petition that's pending here, namely unauthorized practice of law? The flip side of that is, what's the practice of law?
It is certainly connected, and as we argued in our petition for the unauthorized practice of law, we think that in many ways defining the practice of law is important. But I think in this instance, there's no question that someone who holds themselves out as a paralegal is quite clearly engaged in the practice of law, and therefore this court ought to be involved in either licensure and or regulation. Some of the other professions that we've discussed, we had a fair amount of discussion about the incidental nature, but I think quite clearly here the work of a paralegal is on all for the practice of law.
Who among the three of you is going to talk about discipline in the code that's connected here? Because it's not quite clear who's going to enforce all this, and it's going to be, and who's going to fund it.
I think that Attorney Decker will include remarks on that issue in his portion of the presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Banky.
Could I ask a question here?
Justice Bratton.
Madam President, you are going out to bar associations throughout the state and meeting with them, excellent grassroots effort. What are you hearing from the bar about this petition? Are they strongly supportive? Are they against it? Are they indifferent? I mean, what do you hear from the grassroots?
I have been out. There are a couple of other pending petitions which have, shall I say, garnered a slightly higher amount of attention from our members. This petition, as I indicated, was passed, or the support of the petition was passed back in 2000. And at that time, through the work of the Paralegal Task Force, lawyers, were very interested in working together with paralegals because of the need to provide cost-effective legal services and by the sheer reality that if we did not work together, that it was a very real possibility that they would seek licensure directly through the legislature. And there was quite a bit of concern that regulation of paralegals separate from regulation of lawyers by two independent branches of government might present some additional difficulties that no one was interested in undertaking.
Thank you, Ms. Banky. Attorney Decker.
Thank you, Chief Justice and Justices. Good morning. I'm pleased to appear here and to tell you that the time has come. This is a watershed event wherein the lawyers and the organized paralegals of Wisconsin have come together in a long, difficult struggle to present the petition that is before the court today. I've been involved in this issue for the past 13 years, off and on for the last 8 years, working intensively with first the Commission on Delivery of Legal Services, from whence this effort sprang, and then the Task Force on Paralegal Practice. It is a matter, I think, of supreme significance that the paralegals have come along with us and have reached two major agreements with the lawyers. One, the paralegals will practice at all times under the supervision of a licensed Wisconsin lawyer, and that the Wisconsin lawyer will remain accountable for the paralegal's work. And second, that the paralegals agree that they should be bound by a code of ethics similar to that under which attorneys work.
And who enforces the code?
We have, Your Honor, deliberately not made a specific suggestion in the petition on that point because we didn't want to presume. However, if I'm going to presume, and I will to respond to Your Honor's question, certainly there are two agencies of this court in place now, the Office of Lawyer Regulation and the Board of Bar Examiners, which we certainly envision could take on the examination of new applicants in terms of approving their educational attainments when that becomes a factor. And on the discipline side, that OLR would be able to take that on with only a relatively marginal addition to the scope of its staff and responsibilities.
Well, your additional numbers, what are you talking about? Are you talking about 100, 200? How many people are you anticipating?
Justice, I will defer to the paralegals who will be presenting this morning as to the numbers, but I have one caution on that. And that is that I have encountered in trying to answer that question myself and anticipate how many people might apply for licensure, therefore to try to come up with a guess at a fiscal impact, I found that many people are reticent to identify themselves
as paralegals presently, because there is great concern about transgressing the prohibition on practicing law without a license. So much of the activity that's going on now is not widely advertised, although we've presented the court with examples of some advertising that we've found, and some people recently have identified themselves to me as independent paralegals who have no desire to work under the supervision of a lawyer because they, for example, know more about condominium law than any lawyer of their acquaintance. I had that conversation within the last month. So I'm sorry that, from my standpoint, the numbers are a little squishy, but it's not from a lack of inquiry on our part, but I would defer to the paralegals who have a much better handle on the size of their membership, and they have surveyed their membership and others to ascertain the number of people out there in the field.
My next question, and I don't, is the one that I asked the president of the bar, but I will ask you, what I was in, after I read the material, I was envisioning this. When I was a practicing lawyer in the law firm of Wilcox, Rudolph, Kabast, and Rotson, we had a lot of satellite offices in Washera County. We were in.
How many did you have in Washera?
Well, we were in big places like Westfield and Poissippi and Coloma, well known to members here, I'm sure, of activities of legal knowledge. And my question would be, this goes to the supervising lawyer, and I want the people from the bar to think about this, but if I was an enterprising lawyer and I said, all right, we have the law offices of John Wilcox, and they're in Watoma, we have an office there too, in Wild Rose. But in any event, now I'm going to hire 10 paralegals, this came from, and I'm going to put one in Wild Rose, one in all these little communities, and sort of like we called them solicitors. But I mean, basically, when I practiced, we had an office at the bank or someplace like that. But if they had a real big problem, they'd come all the way to Watoma. But for the mundane ones, they might stay in Poissippi. And I was just thinking about, we'd have one lawyer, we'd have 10 or 100 paralegals. This is not to throw any monkey wrench. I just wondered about that because I think that you might hire paralegals or less than you would hire 5 or 6 or 8 lawyers. And do you see any problem with that? If not, is that a service that we're going to provide?
Well, Justice Wilcox, when you first asked Attorney Banky, the immediate thought that popped into my mind was I know of a number of law firms around the state already that are functioning in a very similar fashion, not necessarily with all the geographical dispersal throughout the county or the region, but I know a number of successful law practices in Milwaukee County, Outagamie County, Brown County, and elsewhere that are operating on that model. In other words, one lawyer now supervises and employs 10, 12, 15 paralegals. My old law firm in Milwaukee has 4 lawyers and 8 paralegals. This is a way in which law firms have found cost-effective ways to represent their clients. And so it is something that exists today, and I would say in answering the concern about how adequately can this lawyer or these lawyers supervise these paralegals, it is indeed a serious issue that every lawyer employing a paralegal or any other person to provide assistance has to consider, because it is a very important ethical obligation. The lawyer is ethically obligated for the performance of his or her subordinates, and it is a serious question that any lawyer now or in the future has to answer in employing paralegals.
Let's expand beyond Washera County. As an enterprising lawyer, I'd have Bradley Cooperative Services and maybe specialize in pick an area, but a couple of areas. And like a lot of enterprising law firms, around the state, off the interstate. It used to be next to the courthouse. That's not where it is anymore. Now they're positioning themselves along the interstate with big signs. And so it's going to be called Bradley Legal Cooperative. And I'm going to have 20 of these around the state. I will hire a couple of experienced attorneys also, and we'll be located someplace. But we'll have 20 of these. Each one has 4 or 5 paralegals operating. We're located. The three attorneys are located in Madison with these from everywhere from Hudson to Green Bay, Marinette, Kenosha, Racine, Milwaukee, Waukesha, Brookfield, La Crosse, Westby, all over. I see under the proposed SCR 7.5 that happening. And I see it happening as soon as this is passed. And it isn't just, a law firm that has a satellite office in the bank building or one attorney who has four paralegals. But I see it because it makes dollars and cents, because you can make money on it, and because you could also get less expensive legal services around the state, and that they have a flat hourly rate of $45 an hour. Is the bar in support of that picture?
Your Honor, I have two responses to your question. The first is, we already have seen in the last decade or so any number of imaginative, ingenious marketing devices put together by individual lawyers or by firms or by amalgamations, formal and informal, of law firms using newly minted law school graduates to perform the more basic work. We are also seeing and have seen in this state and in others firms of paralegals coming forward, advertising their services. And the bar's concern, my concern, is that those ingenious individuals marketing the paralegal services are doing that without the supervision of a lawyer whatsoever and without the constraints of a code of professional ethics. And that's why I quoted that statement from the partial dissent, Justice Hallows. There, in that case, talking about people who are not lawyers, who have not had legal training, practicing a part of the law, and the concern expressed by Justice Hallows was these people are doing so without being accountable to the public, to the courts, to the rest of the profession, through being held to high standards of ethical conduct.
Counselor, I can see that what you're proposing is an effort to, improve the delivery of legal services to people in Wisconsin, and certainly that's laudable. One of my major concerns, however, is how are we going to fund people to supervise an exam, people to supervise CLE, people to supervise practice if there's an allegation made that we have yet another body of folks that this court is responsible for when the governor keeps telling us we have to cut our budget, not increase our budget?
I will defer to Attorney Donahue on the education portion, if I may. However, I do have a response. I think this is an important inquiry. Certainly every entity and unit of government these days is strapped, and finances are a concern. But as I indicated in a previous answer, I believe existing bodies, existing agencies of this court can take on that work.
Well, they can take it on, counsel, if they get more staff.
Right.
At the present moment, I think they're working at capacity. And they are both funded by lawyers. There's an assessment that the Supreme Court puts on to all the lawyers in the state, and it's part of the bar dues, but the bar is very careful in explaining they have nothing to do with it. that all that money is at the order of the court, and if you think it's too high, come on up and see us. I mean, that's, and I think that's right. We put it on, we tax, we spend, we're responsible on that. So if this is going to be funded, it's not going to be funded by present funding. It has to be funded by additional funds. And there'll be additional funds that are either going to come from general revenue, so you can join us in the budget fight if you'd like, or you can assess the lawyers, or you can assess the paralegals, or any combination thereof.
Yes, and this discussion was had at the Board of Governors. I made the presentation at that time in 2000. The Board of Governors discussed it. Constituents of governors discussed it. We come to the court fully aware that the paralegals who would be licensed and all of the lawyers of Wisconsin would
be licensed. Whether they have paralegals or not. Whether they use paralegals or not.
Correct. Correct.
Well,
would
what?
It would.
All the paralegals and all the lawyers of Wisconsin would, I interrupted you.
Would be required to pay an assessment. And to the lawyers who support this petition, the lawyers recognized it would mean an increased assessment. That was clearly understood by the Board of Governors when they adopted this resolution. Overwhelmingly, I can tell you, the minutes only said it was a 60% approval because it was treated as a legislative proposal, and that's how the minutes always reflect. But the vote, by voice vote, was overwhelming with only a few muffled dissents. The lawyers understand this, and they that they will pay more.
Mr. Decker, if I could, I want to refer to two letters that have been submitted as part of the petition packet. The March 16, 2004 letter from James Moore, and the October 8, 2004 letter from the Paralegal Association of Wisconsin, signed by John Goody. Mr. Moore points out that currently paralegals must work under the supervision of an attorney now, and that the attorneys are regulated. Mr. Goody points out that Wisconsin stands to be the first state to require mandatory regulation of paralegals. Now, given the current regulation of attorneys, exactly what is the need for this court to become the first court to reach out and do mandatory regulation of paralegals? What's the necessity here?
I may be mistaken, but I thought New Mexico already had taken that step. But regardless, we have an integrated mandatory bar association. The lawyers came to this court years past and said, we recognize that as officers of the court, we have a special obligation to the court, to the profession, and to the public. And we think in order for meaningful regulation to apply, it should not be simply by a purely voluntary or self-styled group. As Justice Hallows mentioned in the case I alluded to earlier, when regulatory bodies are composed primarily or even exclusively by the persons who are regulated themselves, their interest tends to run to professional and self-interest and not the public interest. And we urge the court to make this mandatory for anyone who would call himself paralegal, in order to better protect the public interest.
If you don't call yourself a paralegal, can you do the same work that a paralegal does?
One could without applying for a license, but we found in our work over these years that paralegal is by far the preferred term and has come to be a term of art. Legal assistant has devolved, if you will, and is no longer a term of art. It covers a broad range of people who work in law offices, from people who do the drafting of documents and preparation of discovery to people who answer the telephone. So paralegal is the preferred term and one that has acquired a particularized term of art meaning.
Thank you, Mr. Deck.
Justice Bradley.
What keeps legal assistants, not paralegals, this Bradley cooperative that I'm planning to start, why can't I fill those offices with legal assistants around the state, doing the same thing with the same highway access and the same neon light saying Bradley Cooperative Legal Services? Then they don't have to be, I'm being a bit facetious, but my point is you can have the same thing, apparently, according to your response, but they're just not regulated.
That's true, but the people who perform the work by far prefer the term paralegal.
Well, but this whole petition, this whole regulatory scheme has to be more, it seems to me, be based more than on, and I'm sure I'll hear it's based more on a preference of title over substance. It seems to me in your response you've said we could have this Bradley Cooperative. They could be doing all the same work. The substance is the same. The only difference is a different label which would kick into a regulatory scheme.
Here would be the significant difference that I would see and the real practical difference that I would see in the field. Those who are regulated and licensed as paralegals fall within a regulatory scheme. Those who do not are not in that regulatory scheme, and as we think about this petition dovetailing with the unauthorized practice of law petition, I would think that the regulated paralegals would not be exposed to prosecution for unauthorized practice of law in the manner that the unregulated, self-styled legal assistants would be.
What could a paralegal do that a legal assistant couldn't do?
This was a matter we discussed in our deliberations in the task force. And we concluded that the term legal assistant really wasn't terribly useful because it covered such a broad area. But we have not attempted to line out or line in any particularized activities as being paralegal activities as opposed to lawyer activities as opposed to something else. Out of the concern that when others have attempted to do that, notably the American Bar Association, in attempting to define the scope of the practice of law, they've run into a buzzsaw. I don't know of anybody really who's been successful at such an effort in the history of the organized profession dating back to the 1870s. And it was our desire not to come up with laundry lists so that lawyers and law offices and trial courts would establish the parameters of this practice on a basis that is capable of evolving. We were concerned not about drawing bright lines, because I remembered clearly from the Commission on Delivery of Legal Services all the concern expressed by lay advocates who appeared in court on behalf of victims of domestic violence. And we did not want to rule things in and rule things out. We wanted things to develop in a free market economy, to rely upon the ingenuity of lawyers and paralegals and judges as we face the problem of working out how do we deliver more cost-effective legal services to the public, particularly in these areas that are not remunerative.
Counsel, let me say on behalf of the court, that, you know, we're asking tough questions, I think. And I think you think so, too. Not that they're original with us, your responses and Ms. Benke's responses, and I'm sure Ms. Donahue's responses, and everyone else is going to talk. They've thought about these, and you have to make choices when you draft a petition. And in life, you make choices, and they're not perfect. You know, if it was perfect, it would be easy. It wouldn't be a choice. So What I should have said at the beginning, but I want to say now, is a lot of work and effort and thought has gone into this petition, and the court recognizes that and understands that and appreciates that. And our questions, which are designed to delve into the problems, not the great things in the petition, that's easy, but into the problems of it, are designed for that and should not be considered by you or Ms. Banky or Ms. Donahue or anyone else in this audience as not appreciating the problems of practicing law, whatever that is, right? And various assistants who work with lawyers and do great things. All of us have practiced law and have had assistants, whether they fall into one category or another. And as judges, we use assistants, both lawyers and non-lawyers. So the court is aware of this, and I think everyone should take these questions as an attempt to understand what the difficulties are, and that in full appreciation of all the effort that went into this.
I appreciate that, Chief Justice, and I can say that the court has tossed me tough questions in the past and still ruled in favor of my client's cause.
You're still standing, right? Good. Thank you, Mr. Decker. Ms. Donahue?
Good morning, Chief Justice and other justices. I'm pleased and honored to be here. Based on the Chief's last remarks, I assume all the difficult questions are done. The acknowledgement of the difficult work of the task force has been made. But I just want to very briefly talk a little bit about the educational and ethical requirements that the task force is proposing that the court consider. When I started the practice of law a quarter of a century ago, and I get to say that now, and I love saying quarter of a century because I feel pretty old these days, and I've been doing this for a long time. I was with Legal Services in Northeastern Wisconsin, which also practiced in Washera County. And we had a number of paralegals on our staff. We were able to leverage our services pretty well with paralegals doing Social Security and welfare hearings. They had no specific training. We taught them on the job. We supervised them carefully, and after a while, the paralegals who worked for us were exceptionally competent and dedicated to their clients. In the 80s, even before I went into private practice, I started teaching in a paralegal course of study at Lakeshore Technical College outside of Sheboygan. I taught family law for a number of years. By that time, the profession was beginning to develop courses of study for paralegals that I felt at the time, looking it over, provided a rigorous course of study in the areas and additional areas as set out in our petition. Right now, one of the things about having been around for so long is my opportunity to watch the evolution of the practice of law and being in different areas of law in a legal services job and now in private practice for 15 or so years is that we are constantly looking to do a wide variety of things as lawyers. Those of us in private practice, quite frankly, are looking at making money. We support our families and we assist our staff in supporting their families. Second, and particularly in the firm that I'm in, but I'm sure it's true of all law firms, is we really strive mightily to perform and to provide the best quality legal services that we can for our clients at as reasonable a price as we can provide. The use of paralegals in that respect makes sense. Calling them paralegals, regulating paralegals, licensing paralegals so that a standard of services can be provided, in this respect, to me, makes ultimate sense at this point. The proposed educational rules, I think, reflect what the Chief Justice referred to as this long process. And I must tell you, these meetings went on and on. Surely the League of Nations did not take as much time to form as the paralegal task force process has taken. But considering the perspective of all kinds of people who were to be affected by this rule, the educational requirements, I think, reflect a flexibility that allows paralegals to, in fact, become licensed without either through an educational process or through a grandfathering process. It is important, I believe, that paralegals be held to high standards. Again, if we call them paralegals, if we license them, if we regulate them, as with lawyers, we can do that. The ethical standards that we have are the proposed ethics code, drafted in part with the assistance of the Professional Ethics Committee, I think assures those kind of high standards. That's all I have to say, and as I say, I'm sure that Mr. Decker absorbed the questions that you might have had, but if you have any further, I'd be happy to try to address them.
Is not complete agreement on what the educational program should be, at least from the letters we've gotten, nor on the grandfathering.
And I appreciate your remarks, because this is an exceptionally complicated, difficult area. My mom graduated from nursing school in 1946 and slowly watched the professionalization of her profession over the years before she retired in 1982. And she saw some good things and some bad things about it. But the plain fact is that the practice of law, both from a substantive as well as just from a business perspective, is changing. It's becoming more complex, and this is a way to try to deal with it. The good part about this particular task force report, as opposed to perhaps a legislative process, is the extraordinary amount of time that went into considering all of these questions and all of the issues that face the court now. This is our best attempt. I frankly think, as I participated in the process, it's a fine product. And quite frankly, I don't see a legislative process producing a better product or dealing with the issues that we bring before you. From my perspective, calling a paralegal, licensing and regulating that person does nothing but to help to improve the quality of the practice of law, the quality of services we deliver to our clients, and to the professionalization of the paralegal practice, which I think is a good thing.
Counsel, what are there some unmet legal needs that will be addressed by the regulation of paralegals? And I ask that question of you because of your background and your breadth of experience. You've mentioned, you know, the quality of the practice of law will be enhanced, and the professional designation will enhance the profession. But how does the regulation of paralegals affect any unmet legal needs that you might identify?
I don't think there's any direct line. I wish I could stand before you and say, because then I surely would have. You know, if we start licensing paralegals, the need for legal services for low-income people in this state will decrease dramatically. I just don't think that's a line that you can draw from point A to point B.
So it is primarily, I don't know if I got all of the, you mentioned the quality of the practice of law. I mean, certainly I understand that. And also the enhancement of the profession by a certification, certified designation. And what is, did I miss another one? Is there something else that you think that really is important for us to consider that would prompt us to embark upon a large enterprise?
My response would be is that when I go to my doctor's office and I'm treated by a physician's assistant, I'm very happy that that person is regulated and trained and licensed and accountable to a doctor. Okay. It's a way that my physician has of reducing costs. It's a way that I have of still getting good quality service, but knowing that there is a structure in place to make sure that when I walk out of there, I'm better off than when I walked in. And that's the best analogy that I have. I do think that The unmet legal need, when John Skilton, as president of the bar, went around the state and talked to people, the outcry for legal services for poor people was extraordinary. I think it was an eye-opener for all sorts of folks. This is not a particular solution. It certainly doesn't hurt it. It doesn't get in the way of it. I wish I could say it was a great solution, but I can't.
That's why I asked you, because of your background in legal services and so much of your professional career addressing that particular area of legal.
And, you know, I run the legal aid clinic in Sheboygan County, and we have volunteer lawyers who meet with clients at the Salvation Army twice a month. And I never have trouble getting volunteers, but, you know, and there are very few. Sheboygan County is in just a little bit of a time warp. Some of the finest minds of the 19th century are practicing law in Sheboygan County. We don't have a lot of paralegals per se, but I've never thought of asking a lawyer, why don't you send your paralegal? And that does actually give me a thought. And there are a couple of firms in town who designate paralegal services.
Thank you, Ms. Donahue.
Can I ask?
Justice Prosser.
I like to really follow up on Justice Bradley's question. I understood one of the main thrusts of this whole petition was to satisfy unmet legal services. Wouldn't a different approach be to identify very specifically legal services that are being unmet, and then have a regulatory process in which you enable people who are not lawyers to meet those specific services? Isn't that a different approach from the approach that's been
taken? In fact, that is the approach that the legal services community has taken for years and years. The plain fact is that there's not enough money to pay lawyers to supervise paralegals or community volunteers to be on the front line of providing those services. We tried a variety of different schemes of community volunteers meeting with people in counties that were farther from our main offices. The benefits specialists, for example, under Title III, providing services for the elderly, are not paralegals per se. My own view is that if legal services programs had a sufficient amount of money to provide for the unmet legal needs of clients in the state of Wisconsin, they would find effective and efficient ways of doing it. Even back in 1979, we had three paralegals that were providing those kinds of services, and quite frankly, we paid them as we should have. We paid them less than we paid our lawyers, who we didn't pay very much to either. So I think if there were, in my ideal world, there is enough money for legal services for the poor, and you figure out how to leverage those services. And if I were still running an organization that had that much money, I can tell you that regulated paralegals would be a huge part of how we would meet those services, but there would be other ways of approaching it as well.
One last question. Should legal assistants or other people who work in a law office who are not attorneys be subject to ethical rules?
The task force proposal does subject paralegals to, I shouldn't say subject, includes them in certain ethical constraints, including the service of pro bono service. In my law firm, our legal assistants are constrained by the same quality and the same standards we hold ourselves to. Our secretaries hold client confidences. They try to perform their work as capably and as competently as possible. They don't have ethical standards per se, but we impart that in the culture of the firm. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Certainly an attorney is going to be subject to attorney-client privileges and confidences and that sort of thing. What happens if the legal secretary of an attorney just goes and blabs all over town about something?
That's why I have malpractice insurance.
Ms. Donahue.
And quite frankly, if that's because of my lack of supervision or training, my understanding is under the attorney's code of professional responsibility, I'm in trouble as well, as I should be.
Which leads to my question, Ms. Donahue. One of the concerns, and perhaps you can answer this concern for me, about setting up a system that regulates and educates paralegals in a licensed fashion is that, and there's been some alluding to this, is providing legal services in a less expensive way for people that can't afford it, is that what you'll end up with is people who will be out there with the, and everybody's going to assume that these people are trained, perhaps with less supervision by the attorneys, that might ultimately end up in more problems for the litigants and then for the attorneys who are being regulated by this court down the road. Do you have an answer for that concern?
My view is that in an entrepreneurial spirit, and again, the evolution of the of how we practice law in the last 25 years, multidisciplinary practice issues. I was on the Professional Ethics Committee for a number of years. All of the various entrepreneurial ways that we as attorneys are trying to make a living and yet provide high quality of services, people are trying different things. If, in fact, there's going to be the Bradley Law Consortium out on Highway 43, from my perspective, better that the 10 paralegals who are operating under, who are operating in that particular law firm are regulated and licensed. That provides a level of accountability that I think is simply not present today. I'm not familiar with this kind of setup, and that's because I live in Sheboygan. not a big city person, but my view is that to have licensing and regulation of paralegals, even in that particular construct, helps. It doesn't hinder.
Thank you, Ms. Donahue. The marshal will change the tape. I guess maybe it's a disc now. And then we're going to go through our list, and I'm going to impose a five-minute limit on everybody. So I think you'll have an orange light. Is that right? Orange? When it turns red, you know what red lights mean. Orange does not signify go slowly here. In order to conserve time, would Mr. Owen Durgan approach the podium, please? Good seeing you again, sir.
Well, good morning, Your Honors.
Just a minute. Just hold 1 second, please.
I submit that the...
Just a minute. Oh. They're going to give you the signal.
Sorry.
At it? Good. Mr. Durgan.
Thank you. I submit that this proposal has two major problems. First of all, it does not recognize independent paralegals. It implies that anyone who does not work for an attorney is not qualified to call themselves a paralegal, regardless of how much education and legal experience they may have. It's noted that in the bar's final report that this was a major point, and there's quite a bit of disagreement over whether this should be a requirement or not. Of course, I submit that it should not. I submit that independent paralegals should be eligible for any licensing, providing they meet all the qualifications that, that the bar is proposing. Basically, the bar's requirements are pretty much what the paralegal programs are requiring. So I think it should also include paralegals who work independently and also those who practice in front of government agencies. These attorneys practicing in front of government agencies are basically functioning as attorneys, statutory attorneys. Perhaps that's what they should be called. This petition appears to be another attempt by the bar to further restrict the practice of law by downgrading paralegals who do not work for an attorney. Instead of restricting paralegals, I submit that this court should be looking at ways to expand the use of independent paralegals, as they're proposing to do in the state of Illinois. Illinois Senate Bill 2136 proposes to license paralegals, what they call them, legal document preparers, or LDPs for short. The requirements for becoming an LDP are the same as for a bar, except that they do require an examination, too. In fact, periodic examinations. After an LDP would be licensed under this proposal, they would then be able to prepare legal documents independently for a fee. Unfortunately, the Illinois State Bar has temporarily blocked this in its own self-interest. The second problem that I see with this proposal is that, according to Supreme Court rules, attorneys must report any misconduct by other attorneys as well as judges. Under this bar's proposal, paralegals must report other paralegals' misconduct. But nowhere in there does it say anything about a paralegal having to report an attorney's misconduct. Everybody has to report everybody else's, except paralegals don't have to report attorneys. Again, the bar is protecting itself here. I submit that paralegals should be required to report other attorney misconduct as well, including any attorneys that they may be working for. Under this proposal, a paralegal working for an attorney could observe the attorney's misconduct for a period of several years without reporting it. And if this court eventually caught up with the attorney and suspended or revoked his or her license, the paralegal could freely admit that he or she has observed this for a period of several years and have a perfectly clean record. I submit that this is an absurd result. One positive aspect of the proposal is it does distinguish between paralegals with a two-year certificate or a four-year degree and those that have only a six-month certificate or none at all. But I submit that academic credentials are not the best way to determine competence. I submit that the best way is through examination, both, and I think this is true for both attorneys as well as paralegals. Examination prior to licensing and then periodic examinations afterward, as the Illinois State Bar is proposing. I think this should the licensing should be by specialty, and I think that should be for attorneys too. I think this would prevent a lot of legal malpractice that's now going on. Too often, attorneys decide that somebody who's maybe never litigated a case decides he wants to try his hand at litigating. Or
Durrigan.
Yes.
Your time is up. Do you have a written statement?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
If you would you, I know you have notes or something.
I have notes.
You're free to send in a statement for things that you have not covered or even things you have covered, if that was all right. Okay? Your time is up.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Opie, Director, Paralegal Program, Lakeshore Technical College. Mr. Opie.
Madam Chief Justice and other members of the court, as Justice Abrahamson indicated, I'm the director of a paralegal program at Lakeshore Technical College. It's funny how things come full cycle. As one of the previous speakers indicated, she was an instructor at our program years ago. I'm here on behalf of the six paralegal programs of the Wisconsin Technical College system. One of the things that we thought about that might be an issue was whether or not, should the court adopt this proposal, whether or not there would be adequate educational programs to provide for the education of paralegals. And I'm here to assure the court that we are positioned to deliver those educational services, quality of education. We are all ABA-approved schools. Accessibility, our schools deliver education. We're scattered throughout the state, and we also deliver courses over interactive television, which we could deliver to other campuses, and we also deliver courses over the Internet. So that was the gist of my remarks regarding the accessibility, affordability, and quality of education that will be available should you adopt this proposal.
Is there a demand?
Right now, there is a demand. All of our programs are running full. We graduate probably in excess of 150 to 200 students a year. Whether or not that demand will increase or not, should this proposal pass, remains to be seen. Currently, most, if not all, attorneys that do hiring, at least through the media, the advertisements that I see, require education at this point. Obviously, there's hiring that goes on, and there's promotion that goes on within the firm that I don't see. But there is a demand now, and what would happen if this should pass? I'm not certain.
Have you done any investigation or conversations among your colleagues in the technical system about whether they would be willing to construct and administer a competency exam?
We have not. One of the things that I recall from reading the task force reports was that they noted how there's no competency exam for lawyers in the state as long as they pass through Wisconsin or Marquette. And so it was thought that since lawyers don't have to pass a bar exam as long as they graduate from a school within the state, then there would be no need to add that additional burden for paralegals. So it hasn't been discussed.
Okay, thank you.
Is your program a two-year program?
It is. All of our programs are two-year associate degree programs. Green Bay also has a post-baccalaureate certificate program where someone can come in with a bachelor's degree, and then what they need to do is get the 18 credits as outlined in the proposal. And I might add that those 18 credits, you will see that's consistent with the American Bar Association guidelines, which I'm sure that you all had the opportunity to read this morning, all 36 pages or so, as well as the American Federation for Paralegal Educators. That's a consistent theme throughout the national organizations that regulate paralegal programs, 18 substantive credits and an associate's degree minimum. The other things that I thought I might spend my time doing rather than read my remarks was try to address some of the questions that the justices had brought up on past occasions. Both Justice Wilcox and Justice Bradley were referring to this, you know, a situation where there's an attorney with 20 paralegals, and I think it was indicated that could go on now. There's nothing to prevent that from occurring at this time. I think one difference would be is that if once this proposal is passed, you are now going to have 20 paralegals that have something to lose, and that is their license. And you know, this state regulates, I've got a short list here, barbers, manicurists, funeral directors. Where's my list? Well, it's electrolysists, real estate brokers, real estate appraisers, auctioneers, and social workers. And, you know, think about the services that those people provide. And then think about what paralegals are doing in a law office. They are providing substantive legal work. They are doing the things that absent an attorney, that an attorney would have to do if they were not there. They're doing tasks that require a knowledge of the law. They draft deeds. They draft complaints. They draft answers. They review depositions. They draft wills. They help attorneys prepare for trial. They interview clients. They interview witnesses. And basically, they do everything that an attorney can do, except two things. They cannot give legal advice to a client, and they cannot appear in court on behalf of a client.
Mr. Opie, your red light is on, too.
My red light's on. Okay.
And you, too, are welcome to add any comments you have in writing to the court. They will be considered. And
thank
we
you.
Appreciate your appearance as well as Mr. Durgan's and everyone who comes after you. Thank you. Regina Reynolds, Madison Area Paralegals Association.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. I'm very honored and very nervous to be here before as a representative of Madison Area Paralegal Association. A little bit about MAPA. We are a group of dedicated professionals. We were organized in 1992 as a way to provide professional development and an open forum for active communication surrounding our profession. And the community really responded. The first year we had 10 members, the next year 50, and today I'm happy to say we have 90 members, including 10 students from Madison Area Technical College. Over the past 12 years, we've worked to continue to provide these educational opportunities and networking opportunities, as well as professional development through mentoring programs, working with educators and students, and also increasing our presence in Dane County's legal community. We have volunteers that work with Legal Action of Wisconsin, as well as Dane County's Small Claims Assistance Program. We support the task force recommendation because we feel there are unmet legal needs in this community, and we feel that those working under the professional title of a paralegal need some set of requirements to utilize that title. It's not only a local concern, but as we've heard today, it's also a national concern. In order to meet the needs, I think that paralegals can be utilized to perform some of the tasks that attorneys generally perform. This would be done under the supervision of a licensed attorney. We could decrease billing costs because paralegals are able to draft documents, correspondence, and other things for attorneys' review. We can also respond and provide better access to clients because we can field incoming calls, initiate documents, and very often respond in a timely fashion, which attorneys aren't always able to do. In order to reach those goals, I feel it's necessary to create standards for education and training for those who provide substantive legal work under the supervision of a licensed attorney, i.e. the paralegal. And why is the term paralegal used? The members of the State Bar addressed that, and they chose that term because in their experiences, they identified that individual as the person who was the most qualified member of the staff when the attorney was absent. The task force definition includes concepts such as qualified through education and training, substantive legal work, and sufficient knowledge of legal concepts. The task force adopted the term paralegal over legal assistant because of the evolution of our profession. MAPA also adopted that term early on in agreement.
Mr. Reynolds, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Yes, sir.
Do you have any members who are independent paralegals, or are all of your members working under an attorney?
As far as I know, I believe all of our attorneys work under the supervision of an attorney. A requirement for membership is a certification or attestation by their supervising attorney.
So you don't have any independent members, any independent paralegal members?
Not at this time that I'm aware of.
Are you aware of independent paralegals operating here in Dane County?
No, I'm not.
Thank you.
What does the attestation say?
I'm sorry, I don't have that information in front of me. I believe it states the number of hours that they have been working in the past, I believe, 5 years, and it also indicates that they do it under the supervision of an attorney.
And that they're called paralegals?
Not all of our members use the title paralegal. Some use legal assistant, and I'm not sure if that's just a function of their position within their company.
Give me an idea of what kind of educational opportunity your organization provides for its members.
MAPA provides 2 half-day seminars a year, and we also have 3 educational luncheons. We've had different speakers regarding we've had people from Westlaw come. We have had different attorneys talk about pro bono work. We have real estate people come in and talk about their duties. We've had an attorney come in and talk about the role of paralegal and patent trademark work. There's just been a large volume of speakers we've had over the last 12 years, and we always try to make that function around the role of the paralegal in that profession.
You addressed unmet legal services. What would you focus on as something that the adoption of this proposal would ameliorate?
I don't believe I can identify anything particularly, but I think that there are services we could better help the public reach. Lots of times people are not in a financial situation to pay for an attorney, or they do not have the education to present small claims hearings, things along those lines. So they need the guide of somebody who's been educated rather than trying to present them those issues before themselves, whether it be divorce, small claims hearings, things along those lines.
Ms. Reynolds, your red light's on too, and again, welcome. Thank you on behalf of the court, as I have the others, and urge you, if you have other things unsaid, to file a written statement.
Thank you.
Thank you. James A. Stewart, Educational Approval Board.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice and distinguished members of the court. My name is James Stewart, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of the Educational Approval Board today. My purpose of today's hearing is to request the court recognize the very essential part that the Educational Approval Board has historically played in the paralegal community, and to urge the court to continue this role as it codifies any rules of practice for paralegals. The Educational Approval Board is an independent board established under Section 45.54 of the Wisconsin statutes. It oversees a broad base of educational institutions, including currently three schools offering paralegal studies. The board reviews the business administration of these institutions, as well as the quality and nature of the curriculum, the methods used for soliciting students, post-graduation placement efforts, and many other facets.
Mr. Stewart, just as a matter of curiosity, if I may ask.
Certainly, Justice Bradley.
Previously, we were told that the technical colleges of the state of Wisconsin have six schools, and I just heard you say that the Educational Approval Board handles the approval of three schools.
Proprietary in nature, Your
Honor. Okay. Thank you.
Certainly. In some cases, the board shares its oversight with other agencies that have specific expertise and specialized curriculum to ensure the offerings here in the state of Wisconsin meet the applicable standards for a given profession. The board is the only administrative body whose primary duty is the approving of proprietary schools doing business in this state. Lastly, the board is empowered as a consumer protection agency for the students in these educational institutions, including the power to suspend or revoke a school's approval to do business or to compel payments from bonds to students where appropriate. The board has also been involved in the regulation of distance learning for many years. The proliferation of online scholastic offerings shows no sign of abating, and additional paralegal education will undoubtedly be offered in this format. At least one of the schools currently overseen by the board offers this alternative. New institutions are likely to offer paralegal education through online coursework, and proprietary schools are not subject to oversight by either state board currently referenced in the proposed rule. The ABA's House of Delegates and the American Association for Paralegal Education are limited in the oversight they can provide and offer no practical protection for the Wisconsin resident given unethical practices of institutions of this nature. The board provides a practical means to provide that oversight, as it has done for the schools that are offering paralegal studies over the past 20 years. On behalf of the board, I would encourage the court to review the letter submitted by the director of the Educational Approval Board, David Dees, and the suggested amendment the board has made for this rule. The amendment will ensure continuity to those students who are currently enrolled in a board-approved school, as well as ensuring coverage for those who are contemplating enrollment in such schools. It will ensure a level playing field for existing schools under the board's oversight as new schools or courses emerge in this growing educational niche. The board does not want to expand its original mandate. It merely wants to assist the court by continuing to fulfill its statutory duty. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. We have a written statement from you, as we have from others, but if you wish to add to it, you may.
I certainly could do that, Your Honor, but Director Dees has given you a written statement, and that's probably better.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Attorney Steve Levine, Madison, Wisconsin. Good to see you, Mr. Levine. Haven't seen you for a while. You know, it seems like only yesterday, doesn't it?
Yes. You were in the back of the room.
They also serve who only sit and wait.
Okay.
If it pleases the Court, Your Honors, my name is Steve Levine. I'm an attorney from Madison. I've submitted a written statement, so I'll be very brief. I think there are 3 points that I would like to make in opposition to the State Bar's petition to regulate paralegals. The first point is that there's nothing that's contained in the petition and nothing that's contained in the report that gives any reasons or tries to persuade the Court why paralegals should be regulated, why there's a public need. Have paralegals been committing some great transgression against the public that needs regulation, or are attorneys clamoring for regulation of paralegals? There's no indication that the State Bar surveyed its membership, those people who actually employ paralegals, to see what they think of this proposal, to see if paralegals actually should be regulated and licensed. And so the first point, and I'll be very brief about this, is that I think the Court should expect of the Bar, if you want us to regulate paralegals, persuade us why it's needed, why the public has to be protected, and why lawyers should be protected by regulation. Because I think the only reason for regulation and licensing ought to be protection of the public and not any other reason. The second point that I'd like to make is that this petition really is not to regulate and license paralegals. It's only to regulate and license the use of the name paralegal. As was explained by speakers earlier, any person, they can call themselves a legal assistant, they can call themselves, you know, a domestic law assistant, whatever title they want to use. But they can do exactly the same as what a paralegal could do under this petition as long as they don't use the word paralegal. And I don't understand, if protection of the public is the reason for this petition to regulate paralegals, why it shouldn't apply to anybody who engages in that same conduct. It's as if this Court decided to regulate attorneys and impose certain educational and ethical requirements on attorneys and then said anybody can practice law. As long as you don't call yourself a lawyer, you don't have to abide by the educational requirements or the ethical requirements. All that this petition does is regulate use of the word paralegal. If someone wants to call themselves a legal assistant, they can do exactly what a paralegal would do, and they would escape regulation under this proposal. The final point that I have is, and I mentioned this in my written statement, you've heard this morning from some of the private groups, private paralegal associations that are out there. There are national groups, there are state groups, there are local paralegal groups, all of whom have educational programs, some of whom have certification programs that are doing an excellent job right now. I don't see why the state of Wisconsin should adopt an expensive, complicated bureaucracy to regulate paralegals while the same accreditation, the same educational services are being provided by private groups right now. So I would hope that the Court would say, we're going to defer any action on this petition right now until the State Bar provides us with some further information on why it's important to regulate paralegals. And there seems to be an underlying, maybe an unspoken thought here that perhaps the Court should regulate paralegals because if the Court doesn't regulate paralegals, the legislature may choose to do so. And I don't think that's an adequate reason for adopting a whole system of regulating any profession. That the State Bar ought to be required to come forward with some persuasive reasons, perhaps do a survey of the entire Bar membership to indicate whether the Bar's membership that does employ paralegals feels that regulation is required. That's all that I have, unless there are some questions.
Mr. Levine, I think you said that the only reason for regulation is protection of the public. But if we were to focus on certain unmet legal needs and we were able to develop something that would actually meet some of those unmet legal needs. Wouldn't that be another completely legitimate reason?
It would, but I think the argument can be made that by establishing a system of regulating paralegals, would have to go through the bureaucracy, have to go through the expense of doing that. You're actually creating a barrier to the use of legal assistance that wouldn't be there if you didn't have the regulatory system.
Thank you, Mr. Levine.
Thank you.
Sorry I missed you yesterday.
I'll try to be more prominent next time. You know?
Next time, Mr. Levine. John Goody, Paralegal Association of Wisconsin.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. I'm going to get to the questions because I don't have time to reiterate everything that has occurred for the last 10 years, and I'd like to address some of these directly to Justice Prosser. You talked about the unmet legal needs and what could be done to help accomplish some of those processes that were defined. We have seen areas in the less perhaps savory areas of law that attorneys are not interested in offering their services, landlord-tenant law, Social Security, workers' compensation, uncontested divorce actions, things like this, that are really not cost-effective, or attorneys have deemed them not to be cost-effective for their services, and in turn have outpriced themselves from the common man, the low- and middle-income individuals out there who cannot afford attorneys to do this type of work. Often those same persons are also perhaps not educationally qualified or intellectually qualified to represent themselves. We see this as an opportunity to define persons who are qualified paralegals who have met educational and qualified standards to fill that gap. Under the supervision of an attorney, working with the supervision of an attorney, for the attorney's offices and firms to offer services to the public in those areas where the work may be performed by qualified paralegals under the supervision of the attorney, satisfies, therefore, both potential problems. One, the unmet legal needs are taken care of. Two, the attorneys have satisfied their requirements to fulfill those needs for the public. Justice Bradley, Bradley Legal Cooperative. I worked in my former life for a plaintiff's law firm where we had three attorneys, we had six paralegals. The reality was the paralegals did 90% of the work on those cases. The attorney signed off on the end. Many times the attorney assigned to the case never even met that client until the end of the case. From the time of the interview and the time that those retainer agreements were signed until the check was signed at the end of the case, the reality of it was that the paralegal was the only person to have ever met with that client, did the background work, did the interviews, obtained the medical records, digested them, obtained the medical reports from the doctors. All of that was done by the paralegals, and that was the reality of it. It was very cost-effective for that firm to do that because the paralegals were obviously paid less than the attorneys. I would love to believe that by licensing paralegals, I'm going to have this tremendous increase in my salary. The reality of this, I know I'm not. Paralegals are paid less than attorneys because we are a support personnel. We're there to support the attorneys. We can't appear before the court. And that is probably the major drawback to the issue of salaries. You can't advance the salaries of paralegals to that of a junior associate because you have one tremendous drawback. You can't send the paralegal to court. You can send the associate to court. The reality is after 17 years of practice, if I were to go to law school now and graduate and begin as a junior associate, I'd have to take a cut in pay, which I'm not inclined to do. But firms are looking to hire someone who is all around, you know, that can meet all those needs. They can hire an associate for less than they can pay an experienced paralegal. And I don't think the licensing is going to change that. What the court needs to understand is that the proposal that's before you is not designed to be punitive. It is designed to set minimum standards for practice. to assign what that mandatory education requirement should be, to provide that continuing legal education is imperative to maintaining your qualifications, to advancing your qualifications, and to ensuring the client the best legal services that they can afford and that they can obtain.
May I ask a question, please?
Certainly.
One of the submissions to us, one of the letters that's been sent, said from an attorney, said essentially this. Well, if you pass this petition, what I'll do is just call my paralegals, legal assistants, and we'll escape all of this. How do you address that?
Well, I think the problem is that there's a public perception that paralegals are this educated group of people who are, you know, one tier below their attorneys, and their legal assistants and legal technicians are another tier below that. And when they did study in Florida a few years back, they asked the public what their perception of a paralegal and legal assistant was. And the public responded they believed that paralegals had attained an educational qualification to reach that title and that legal assistants hadn't reached that point yet. And when we appeared before the Office of Oversight, Attorney's Oversight, 2 years ago, one of the members of the Board of Attorney's Oversight, a public member, came up to us after that meeting and specifically said, I always thought the paralegals had to be educated. I always believed that they had to be trained to become paralegals. So I think that there's a public perception that paralegals are trained and qualified to perform those services, and it's not a reality.
Thank you, Mr.
May I ask,
Justice Pratt, in
addressing my concern about unmet legal services, which I thought you did exceptionally well, does there have to be a linkage between the attorney and the paralegal where there's this formal supervision in order to satisfy those unmet legal services?
I think to avoid the perception of the unauthorized practice of law, there needs to be. Unless the legislature is willing to rewrite the UPL laws, and the court is, you know, looking to change some of those as far as appearances or the appearance of representation before a court, then I believe that that linkage needs to exist in all facets. No, it does not. I have been a licensed agent of the Department of Workforce Development for 15 years, representing formerly injured workers before the Department of Workforce Development, and now I represent insurers and employers. No, I'm not an attorney, but I have satisfied the requirements of the DWD to represent persons, and I stand beside my compadres and my oppositions and that same standard, and I believe that that's come with experience and time and effort. There was a time when that was not the case.
That's because the agency permits that.
Because the agency permits it, correct.
Mr. Goody, thank you, and you too may submit any supplemental materials that you like.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. James W. Moore, Attorney Moore.
Thank you, Justice, Chief Justice Abramson. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you. I've met all of you except Justice Butler. Great having you on our court.
Thank you very much.
I'm an attorney in private practice in Hartford, Wisconsin, a community of about 10,000, not as big as Wautoma, but having to be. I have never appeared in this capacity at one of these hearings, but I wanted to come today to tell you how strongly I feel what an extraordinarily bad idea this is. And I've already written a letter about that. I have practiced law for 32 years, and in those 32, oh, and by the way, I'm also on your Board of Administrative Oversight of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, and I've been on that for like 4 or 5 years, ever since it was formed. So I have some concern about attorney regulation and attorney discipline. In 31 years, I have seen lots of problems with attorneys. I have yet to see one problem with a paralegal, ever. And I've described this in my written submission to you as a solution in search of a problem. I have no idea what problem we're trying to address here. I'm all for regulating attorneys. I think, frankly, what we ought to do if we have a problem with people who are practicing law without regulation is we ought to come up with a workable definition of what the practice of law is and then we ought to enforce it, and we ought to say that the practice of law is, whatever that may be, is done by attorneys or people under the supervision of attorneys. But until we have an adequate definition of the practice of law, it seems to me we're spinning our wheels. I want to tell you a little bit about what it's like in a smaller town to practice. I have hired over the years many people who I call paralegals. I have hired people with degrees, certificates from technical schools and colleges, and I have hired those who have had absolutely no connection with the practice of law before I hired them as a paralegal. And I can tell you that in all those years that I have done that, the best paralegals I have been those that have no connection to any certificate or degree or the practice of law. I've learned that to be a good paralegal, at least in my practice, it takes two things, intelligence and a good work ethic. The certificate, the degree, in my experience, is absolutely irrelevant to the quality of the work that the person does. I can teach that person who comes to me what they need to know to be a paralegal in my practice, and I supervise them. I have always regarded the conduct of paralegals in my practice as my responsibility. I have always assumed I bear the ultimate responsibility for them doing quality work and doing ethical work. I would never have it any other way. And I want to point out to you that, at least in my experience, that certificate does not correlate to the delivery of quality work. I have interviewed people with certificates and degrees, and I find one thing universally true about them, a couple of things. First of all, they're very scarce to find in Hartford. Maybe it's true in some of the other smaller towns. I know in the bigger cities they are available, but it's hard for us to find them. And when I do find them, they do come out and interview, and I tell them what the salary range is for that position. They're almost offended because they expect to earn more, and probably they should because they've spent more time on their education and their degree. But I work for some of the most penurious clients in the world, insurance companies, and I can't afford to pay them. The economics of my practice is that I cannot afford to pay what many of those degreed and certified paralegals want to get paid. And I'm not saying they're not worth it. They may very well be worth it. But that's just the economics of my practice in a small town. If I can find them, I can't afford them. And as I said before, it doesn't necessarily correlate to the quality of the service. Which the best paralegals I've had have been people who have been absolutely unconnected with the law, and maybe that's the reason why they've been such good paralegals. I think we ought to come to a definition of the practice of law if there is a problem with people running around unsupervised doing things. The sad part of this petition is that if it is adopted, I will simply be forced to change the title I give to these people to legal assistants, which seems to me to be a little bit devious, but it is perfectly legitimate under this petition, and I'll go on doing exactly what I'm doing. And it seems to me then that we've accomplished exactly nothing except set up another regulatory scheme and required the lawyers of the state to fund it. There's been a lot of talk today about unmet legal services, and Justice Prosser, I know you've asked a few questions about that. If that's the goal of this, that's a worthy goal, and I absolutely endorse that. If there are people, and I don't doubt that there are, who are not getting the legal services they should be for economic reasons, we ought to devise a scheme to give legal services to those people, a way to deliver them in a cost-effective and an efficient and a quality way. But this petition isn't addressed to that. This petition, as Mr. Levine pointed out, is merely to regulate the title paralegal. And if we're concerned, truly concerned, about the quality of legal services to those who can't afford it, let's attack that issue. And that's a worthy one to go after. My red light has come on. Thank you very much. It was good seeing you all again.
Thank you, Mr. Morth. And if you wish to supplement your comments by writing, you may do so also. I have now used up my list. Is there anyone else who wishes to make an appearance and say something? So you should come to the podium. Not seeing anyone come to the podium, we will conclude our hearing on 04-03 in the matter of licensure and regulation of paralegals. The court will be in recess for a few moments, and then we will come back and for open administrative conference. So our hearing session is adjourned. We will meet again in open administrative conference. The marshal will set the table.
when she said that, she put on a uniform.